Welcome to the Brute Strength Podcast, bringing you worldwide experts from all areas of health and fitness. We cover training, nutrition, coaching, and mindset. Welcome your host, strength and conditioning coach, 2012 and 2013 CrossFit Games champ, Michael Cashew. Mind, body, brute.
Hello, and welcome back. This is Michael Cashew, and you're listening to the Brute Strength Podcast. This week, I've got Dr. Andy Galpin back on the show. Andy is a muscle physiology and exercise scientist, as well as professor at Cal State Fullerton. He's a strength and conditioning coach, amongst other things, for professional MMA athletes, endurance athletes, etc. He's the co-author of the book Unplugged and the co-host of the Body of Knowledge podcast. I'm sure I'm leaving some shit off here, but you get the picture. Andy's a super high-achieving individual and just one of the wisest guys that I know in the strength and conditioning field. We start the show off talking about his recent experience on the Joe Rogan Experience. Joe Rogan's podcast is one of the biggest media platforms on the planet. And so I was just really curious how it felt to go on there. And so he candidly shares his experience of going on that show. Then we talk about the nutrition, kind of the debate about nutrition for longevity versus performance. He gives us the cook, baker, and chef analogy for mastering your nutrition. And then we finish off talking about some personal things around productivity, as well as time and energy management. I learned a ton from this guy, just as I always do, and I know you will love this show. So without further ado, welcome Andy Galpin. Andy, welcome back to the show, brother.
Good to be back, man. Good to see you again.
You too, man. Since our last show together, you were on the fucking Joe Rogan podcast, and you've been on some really big stages in your life. You've been a professor. You've started multiple companies. You have been on tons of large podcasts, but this is like one of the biggest platforms, the media platforms on the planet. How did you feel going into that interview?
Man, I'm a teacher, so like, of course I was excited, but it's the same thing for me every day, man. It's what I do. I stand in front of kids and I talk. I mean, my classes are three hours long. So the idea of doing a 3-hour podcast, like, yeah, I mean, again, of course it was exciting because, you know, the platform, but I speak at conferences, I go around, it's what I do, man.
Well, I re-listened to it 2 days ago, and I thought you did a fucking killer job. And one of the things that, you know, I already know about you, but I appreciated your ability to just stick to this kind of thread is your humility around science. You're one of the most knowledgeable people in the world about muscle physiology, but you just admit how little we still know, right? We're learning more and more and more, but there's just so much that we don't know. And I think it's an approach like yours that is actually going to allow us to move the needle forward in every industry. And so I just want to say hats off to you for being able to do that. And we'll kind of get back into that later. So as I was preparing for this, I had written some stuff down initially about talking about nutrition as it relates to longevity versus performance. And then Adi told me about a tweet that you just made to Joe Rogan, actually. And it goes, I love what Joe is doing with his podcast lately for nutrition, but it's still all health, aging, obesity talk. I think if Rob Wolf and I went together, we would crush the nutrition for health versus performance questions, which is just perfect. So my first question is it possible to optimize for in nutrition for both health and performance simultaneously?
Yeah. So before I actually even go there, just so you can all know, because I'm getting bombarded with all this. Yeah, he for sure has reached out. So we're going to make this happen.
Awesome.
I don't know the difficulties been Rob's schedule, but we're going to work something out. So I've been in contact with you. We're working on round two.
Killer.
I think, yeah, sure. There's enough of an overlap. I mean, look, the basics of human nutrition are really not particularly complicated. And I think if you were to write a Venn diagram, in this case with two circles, aging and performance, I don't know what percentage would be in the middle, but it would surely be 50, 60, 70, 80, maybe plus percent are is going to be the exact same thing. It's just the opposite ends of those spectrums where it gets diametrically opposed or perhaps even conflicting. But I mean, if we said, hey, look, can you give me the three or four basic things that an athlete needs to do? Well, if you turn the word, change the word athlete to longevity out, the first three or four things would be the same thing. Eat real food, right? Eat whole foods, eat a variety. Like it's really not that different. I think people get a bit too worried about this. And some examples I could give you would be, okay, great. So if you're optimizing for minimal caloric intake, okay, that's one thing where it may have some potential but highly overstated benefits to aging, but probably not a good thing for an athlete. In fact, clearly detrimental. Mm-hmm. So, but that's really, like, to me, that's pretty freaking obvious. Like, I don't think I have to, I mean, it's obvious, it's a difficult challenge. You guys work with enough athletes to know it's actually difficult to get them to feed enough. That's a surprising challenge. In fact, most non-athletes hear that and they're like, oh, I wish I had that problem. Mm-hmm. Like, fuck, I wish my problem was I didn't eat too much. It's the opposite. So it's really, honestly, it's the stuff on the fringe, and I'm happy to go into a whole number of topics on this, but it's that last little top part where they can be a bit screwy. But the base of the pyramid, man, the base, the middle, the center, the top 23%, it's still really pretty much the same thing.
Right. Yeah, I do want to talk about those things on the fringe. But first, why do you think there's such debate around, is it just because people want to be in a camp and they want to put their flag in the ground?
It's part of it. It's also part of attention seeking. Mm. In terms of, I mean, no subliminal taking shots at a company here, but look, you're trying to get attention. You're trying to sell product. You want people to go with your thing. It behooves you. In fact, I just put out a tweet this morning about this. It behooves you to be the groundbreaking person, the innovative team, the thought leader, which means you're constantly putting out the new thing. Well, the reality of it is performance nutrition, health nutrition doesn't really change very often. And so mm-hmm. What are you going to do? How are you going to continue to get attention? There's only so many before and after pictures you can post. Like, you want to be the thought leader. And so I think, to me, that's what drives it. It's like groundbreaking new thing that says this is going to help your mental acuity. Or we've found out that this causes Alzheimer's, so our new program. No, it's not really how it works. It's not how science works. It's not, like, it's extremely rare to have a single groundbreaking study like that that really changes how we do things. Mm-hmm. So I think, to me, that's probably, it's just wanting the attention, consciously or subconsciously. I'm not saying it's always nefarious, but that I think is why it is. It's like we want to have a single solution for things. We want to have a scapegoat. And when you've tried three or four scapegoats and that didn't fix your problem, and you hear one that could finally be it, then it's always going to be invigorating to people, and because they want solutions with extremely simple rules. And this is one of the reasons why I say a ketogenic diet has taken off very well, and I think will continue to take off, is because the rules are tremendously simple in terms of high level. Right? Don't eat carbohydrates, period.
Yep.
That's not really true, but
almost. Right? Like, almost, yeah.
So as opposed to, like, okay, here's a great diet. It's fantastic. And here's the 18 things you have to do. That's just not going to glamour as much. Like, you can imagine the title of an article, you know, like the one food you should never eat again. Like, that's going to get infinite clicks, right? Yep. People are going to be like, great, fantastic. So I think that's a lot. That's a big part of it.
Gotcha. And is this need for simplicity, is it tied to just our human desire for certainty?
Probably. I'm not a psychologist or anything of the sort. I don't know enough about human desire in that respect. But yeah, man, like, I can just speak from, like, when I hear about a topic that I'm not an expert in, I think about, why am I making this choice? Why did I pay attention to that commercial? Mm-hmm. And so that's the only thing I can draw on, not particularly the science. But yeah, like, if I'm thinking about my taxes or how to fix my plumbing or something, I'm going to be like, buy this. This is it. This fixes the problem. Done.
Right.
Like, great.
Lowest energy possible.
Totally.
Yeah. So what are some of those things in the fringe? What are people doing to live longer that might be inhibiting their performance and vice versa?
Yeah, I think, for example, on Joe's show, he just had a couple of people on, and I'm not going to go through the details of it because I wasn't particularly interested in watching it because I knew exactly how it would play out. You have a scientist on there, and then you have a person who's just going to repeat anecdotal story after anecdotal story and continue to move the goalposts, right? So I'm not listening to them watch that show. But the point being, like, okay, you want to find a single culprit for all of your health problems. It's extremely unlikely that's true. So kind of what I'm getting at here is one example is sugar. I mean, first of all, we have to unpack what the hell sugar even is, because the vast majority of you probably sitting there listening, no offense, but don't know really sugar is. Like, there's the nomenclature, the common, what the vernacular is or the lexicon is, but then there's the actual chemistry or what a nutritionist or dietitian would actually know. And these are all four separate probably things, probably four different definitions, literal definitions, and actual practical implementation of sugar. And so when we come to something like that, it's like, okay, you want to go on and talk about how all the scientists in the world agree sugar is bad for you. No. Okay. Maybe all the obesity scientists, maybe all the cardiovascular disease scientists, but not all the sports performance scientists. Why? Because look at the sports performance research. It's extremely helpful for acute sport performance. Extremely helpful. And so that's just what I mean. It's just like, well, there has to be context behind this conversation. So what happens, though, is people take information, say, from a molecular biologist that goes on Joe Rogan's show, and they talk about the toxic potential of sugar, or an obesity scientist, or journalist for that matter, and they talk about sugar, this sugar, this sugar, sugar. Well, then an athlete hears that and goes, oh my God, sugar is just, it's got all these toxins in it. Mm-hmm. And like all this stuff that doesn't apply to them at all if they're not in a caloric excess, if they're not concerned with this, if they're in acute performance. So, I mean, that is one of the many, many, many examples of, what are we talking about here? Are you talking about added unnecessary processed sugar? Mm-hmm. Are you talking about natural sugar? Are you talking about monosaccharides? Are you talking about starch? Like, what the hell are you actually talking about? And the vast majority of people can't answer that question. And so it just gets lost, and they hear the oncologists, they hear the cardiologists, and they hear all the health related people talk about the negative effects of health, but that's not even close to what's happened on the performance side of it. And so that's one.
So is the issue here, is it almost seems the exact same problem that we have in the general media, where TV stations just want to find like that clickbaity negativity so that people, they'll increase viewership, right? Are scientists doing the same thing with their papers?
Well, I wouldn't say they're, no, it's not in the papers, because typically scientific papers are written extremely clear.
Objectively, yeah.
It's the interpretation, and it's the way, here, this is actually this very salient point. It's not the fault or the conscious effort of the scientists. It's simply their matter of perspective. And what I mean by that is, if you brought me on and you wanted to talk about health and you just asked me, like, Andy, what's an important thing that everyone should do with their health? Like, I've done these shows for like local radio or NPR.
Yeah.
Well, because I'm a muscle guy, because I'm a strength training guy, like, I'm just going to see it from the lens of those things, right? That's just where my gut goes to. That's just where my heart goes to. That's just my first thought, right? So if you ask an obesity researcher, hey, what do you think about nutrition for health? Like, they're just assuming you're thinking about obesity prevention. And that's just the dependent variable. That's the outcome measure that they're always going to think about as the primary, unless you specify something else. So it's not the fault of them, but I think, to me, the responsibility goes back on you at home listening and to think, okay, I'm going to listen to somebody talk about nutrition. What's that person's background? Like, who are they coaching? Who are they probably consciously and subconsciously talking to? Oh, you're listening to a dietitian who's working with NFL players. Okay, that person's just natural tendency to be directed towards is probably sport performance. You're listening to somebody who's works with eating disorders. They're going to be very sensitive to setting up behavioral interventions and not screwing. And so it's not, I think it's the responsibility of the person listening to not think that they're biased, but we're all biased. We're 100% biased towards our sort of jam. And that's not a negative. It's not an insult. It's just like, that's where my head goes, you know, in those micro situations. So I think that is the biggest culprit. If we could get people that listen to Joe Rogan to think about that. So when Rhonda Patrick goes on, you don't take sports training advice from her. Mm-hmm. That's no offense, like the at all, but like she's a biologist who's super interested in aging. Like half the shit she says, actually, you can't even take because it's going to violate USADA and WADA.
Right.
Right. And I'm not against those things at all. Like, but like we just have to think about that, right? Her outcome is like it's very little exercise related, and she doesn't even really exercise herself, mm-hmm. right? Like, so to just why would you take that if you're trying to take advice from her about maximizing your exercise performance? Like, it just it would be as stupid as taking your anti-aging advice from me.
Right.
Like, I don't know what to do. Don't come to your advice from me when you get diagnosed with cancer. Right. I don't know what fucking supplement to give you. That's a stupid thing to do. So that's kind of what my perspective on that is.
I really love your initial analogy too about like 60 to 70% of it is exactly the same. Like if you're getting those big rocks, like the most important things done, like eating whole foods, eating micronutrient dense foods, eating a variety of foods, you're going to be healthy. You're going to perform well. And I love what you said on Joe's show about like the physiology doesn't care that much, right? Your body doesn't recognize these like tiny micro differences that you're trying to optimize for, which just sounds just like truth. Like that when that hit me, it just feels like truth. It can't possibly matter this much.
Yeah. Like you have to think about it a little bit. I probably used some more colorful language on that show. I can't exactly remember, but like we're not that sensitive in terms of, I guess maybe a better way to think about it is it takes a lot bigger magnitude of change to cause a physiological response. If mm-hmm. that were not the case, you would be responding to every little thing massively, right? So things can have an effect, but there's a physiological dosage. So we'll kind of go back to the question a second ago about performance versus aging or longevity, et cetera. If you say, I'm not going to give you the full Monty on this one.
Yep.
I'm going to give you a little dosage here. But right now it's extremely popular for people to try to minimize a molecular signal in the body called mTOR. Okay, mTOR is an anabolic signal and it helps you grow muscle. Well, some animal and cell culture models have shown that's associated with poor longevity. And so now people are advocating taking huge doses of pharmaceutical drugs to block mTOR. And because I think this is associated with aging, and this is all based on studies from cell culture from fruit flies and from worms that show when you block this protein, you live 20 to 30 to 40% longer. Okay, well, let's think about that for a second. Like, you really think blocking the cellular mechanisms that tell you to grow muscle is a good idea? Do you know what the number one difficulty with aging is? The number one reason people die, the number one reason you go into assisted living homes?
Muscle atrophy, it's lack right?
Bingo, right? So you want to block that? Yeah, you might have the cellular ability to live an extra 30 years, but you're going to be living in a home because you're going to have such small muscle. You're going to have such poor quality muscle. And in addition, do you really think that number carries over? Like, do you really think, I guess if you live in a petri dish, possible. But there's too many other variables in the world. There's too many other things that are going on in the human experience that make us so much more dynamic that are things. So is it physiologically moving the needle? Perhaps. Is that enough for your body to make a whole wide sweeping change of how the physiology operates? You wouldn't want that. You want the physiology to be fairly stable. It's going to take things. It's going to balance. It's going to be a mosaic. And then it's going to come right back to form unless that stress is continual or obvious or massive. So we're really not that sensitive. It behooves your physiology to be able to handle a bunch of different things. And to sort of what I always say is, you know, I'm a big fight fan. So one of my favorite fighters of all time, Wanderlei Silva, would always just say, bite down your mouthpiece, tuck your chin, and just start swinging. And that's what the body really does. It's like, okay, some shit's coming in here. Just bite the mouthpiece, tuck your chin, and just brace, sit down, stay stable. If it's big enough to push me over, I'll adjust. If not, I'm probably just going to stay here, weather this storm, and be the exact same way.
Mm-hmm. You know, they say some of us are more like worms than we are like each other.
Fair enough.
So let's talk about compliance in nutrition. Because we can talk all day about what the perfect diet is, but if people aren't complying with something and being consistent with their diet, then they're probably not going to get some kind of reach some kind of long-term goals. So I've heard you give the cook, baker, chef analogy. Can you repeat that briefly for us?
Sure. It's my way of explaining how I try to take a little bit of the soft science and really just be a human with the way that I interact with my athletes. And so the way I break it down is we all understand the difference between cooking and baking. And by that, I mean, most people don't. If you're a cook, then you're going to say, all right, turn the burner on, put some oil in the pan. Okay, there's a protein, grab that, throw that in the pan. There's some vegetable. Okay, there's some starch, throw it in the pan, put hot sauce on it, put some salt on it, add some cheese and avocado and sour cream. And you're like, there's no exact recipe. It's cooked by concept, right? And it's like, okay, Coach Adi said more protein, so I add a little bit more protein this time. She said back down the starch, so I put a little bit less starch. Okay, it's just coaching by concept. And people who like that, this is the person who, if I said, hey, I'm going to coach you for free for the next month, we'll talk on the phone a couple times a week, and we'll just talk about concepts, and I'll just give you advice like, hey, let's go a little higher in protein. All right, let's cut down the fat a little bit, or let's cut down protein, let's add fat. Right? We're going to talk high-level concepts. And some people hear that and go, like, fantastic, that's exactly what I want. And then some people, like my wife, and this is how I kind of came up with this, she's like, What do you mean more protein? Like 3 ounces, 2 ounces? What do you mean? Like what do you mean more fat? Like 6 almonds, 8 almonds? What are you talking about? Like, I don't understand. I have a teaspoon, tablespoon. I'm like, oh my God. And so she, in my opinion, is more of the baker. And baking as opposed to cooking, baking is extremely specific. There's a recipe, right? You can't just, well, I'll turn the oven on to 300, 400, 500, something like that. Put some baking soda, baking powder. I don't know, some little bit flour. I don't know. Like, if you do that, you're going to have a pile of shit in the oven. It's going to be terrible, right? Baking is chemistry. It is not 4 almonds. It is 4.3 almonds. That's exactly what I said, right? Mm. I did not say 4.5 almonds, right? It's very, very detailed. So some people hear that and go, perfect. I want to know exactly what to eat, when to eat it, tell me exactly what to do. And that actually relieves their anxiety from not having all the information. People who are, though, would fall into my cook camp, that's too much information. They actually get anxiety from all that detail because now it's like, I got to follow this and I have no freedom and I feel confined and cool. And so what I have found in my experience is the first thing I try to figure out when I have a new client or athlete, in my case, it's always an athlete, is, okay, how does this person want my help? How am I going to communicate to them? Am I going to, and sometimes the first thing after, you know, a decent size, large payment and like a lot of conversation and a lot of background information, they might get an email from me that says something like, I just want you to have 3 egg whites before dinner. Like, that's the whole thing. Okay, right. Great. And we'll come back in 3 weeks. Oh, shit. Okay. And that's going to fix my sleep problems? I think it will. Great. Okay. The other person, it might be, you know, the exact same information came in, the exact same scenario, but a different personality type. And I might go, no. Here's exactly what I want. And they might get a template for exactly what to eat all day throughout.
What are the signs that someone is a cook or a baker off the bat?
So it's typically a combination of how they give me information, right? So I can tell right now, like one of the athletes I've worked with for a long time, he's very much a baker. The first conversation, it's like he has his notebooks out.
Right.
He has his Excel files ready.
I know
he
knows this exactly. Person, yes.
And I'm like, copy that. Okay. Yep. Like, if I turn around and tell you, like, all right, let's go up a little bit in fat, I know that's not going to be a satisfactory answer for you. I know it's not. If they're a person who seems to be extremely sporadic and chaotic and their brain is everywhere, I probably need to give them very, very few instructions. Mm-hmm. They might want more. They might say they want more. They actually want more, but they will never execute it. And it's always going to be something else, something else, something else, right? So I want to give them extremely small. No, you don't get the opportunity to get more information until you show me you can execute that for 3 weeks. If you want more information, go hire somebody else because you have to show me you're going to execute this first.
Right.
Before we can start talking about taking nightly infusions of a blind's mane. Like, show me you can eat breakfast routinely or whatever we're doing, right? Mm-hmm. Or not eat breakfast routinely, whatever the hell we're trying to do. right? No coffee enemas until they show me you can eat a vegetable regularly.
I'm going to be sneaking those in regardless.
I know you. I know you would. So that's what I'm looking for. Now, in my experience, we can get to chef a little if you want, but typically when you have competition coming up or you have an extremely specific time and or thing you're training for, I find it's generally beneficial to kind of move into baker mode, right? Because the problem with chef is if you're not calibrated, or is the problem with cook is if you're not calibrated to something like add a little bit more fat, if your definition of a little bit more fat and my definition of a little bit more fat is off, and you've got a weight to make or you've got a scale to hit, that's going to be a huge problem. And so in those cases, I'd rather say, no, you've got to be at 125 pounds in 6 weeks, half a tablespoon of peanut butter, that's it. I hate weighing stuff. I don't give a shit. Weigh it right now. You got to wait for 6 weeks, and after that, you don't have to wait anymore. Okay, fine. But sustainable, long-term, typically a baker is better. A cook is better because it's more conceptual, high level. It's not such an intrusion on your lifestyle.
Right.
But it's really, really hard to be a good cook if you didn't at least spend 6 weeks, 2 months, at least trying to be a baker. Because most people just grossly over-exaggerate, under-report calories.
Yes, yes.
Know, certain size, things like that. And so you need to understand, like, if I give you a carrot, is there 5 grams of sugar in a carrot? Is there 50 grams of sugar in a carrot? Like, how much protein is really in broccoli? How much is that as usable? Like, if you're like 3 grams, 35, 80, like, and most people just, they're so uncalibrated that spending a little bit of time, even if it's a pain in the ass for a month or two, you just need to enhance your understanding of food nutrition. And then from there, then we can slide you back into cook mode and we can just talk by concept. But talking by concept is hard to do if you don't know any information.
Such a phenomenal analogy. You actually went, I think, a layer deeper with like being the chef first in order to be a good cook. I love that. I love that addition. I almost feel like fucking with people and not talking about the chef. People would go crazy. What's the chef? Tell us what the chef is, Andy.
I think when I did it on my show, my podcast, I don't remember if we actually told them or not, but I remember I did that. I might have made them wait to the next episode, or I didn't tell them at all. I can't remember. I just remember getting hammered by it. Like, what the fuck is the chef? And I was like, oh yeah, sorry. I just probably forgot. It's probably, I just talked too much and forgot to come back to it. I don't remember. Maybe it's clever. I don't know. So I'm actually lucky. I got Chef Brooke in my house right now, right? So
nice.
Shout out. You guys can check out the WAG recipes if you want and see some of her stuff on there. But a chef is somebody who can, like, a chef doesn't have to follow baking recipes, right? So if Brooke wants to walk out here out of the bedroom and she wants to make me some biscuits or whatever, she doesn't have to look up a biscuit recipe, right? Because she understands each ingredient and what it does at such a high level that she can make substitutes. She knows, okay, I don't have baking soda, so I can actually put this in instead, but it has to be this volume. Or since I put in this type of flour, that's not going to work well with this, so now I got to do this over here, right? Me, if I don't bake, but if I did, I would have to follow the exact recipe because I don't know what everything's doing. So any slight deviation might be a problem because I don't understand the actual chemistry, the literal chemistry in this case, but she does. So a chef in my mind is somebody who understands the chemistry, the physiology, the science behind these things at such a high level, they can make substitutes. And eventually what they can do is they can start breaking these rules, right? So Chef Brooke can break the rules of baking, can break all the rules that you're probably taught in culinary school because she understands things at such a high level. The problem is when people want to start off day one as being a chef. I mean, can you imagine if you started a restaurant tomorrow and you were the head chef and you're like, I don't need to go to culinary school. I don't need to worry about actually cooking before here. I'm just going to start and be the head chef.
Grilled cheeses.
It'd be a train wreck. Yeah, right? And those would probably suck. So in order to become a chef, she had to spend, I mean, literally in this case, she had to invest months or years of her life following the rules at an extremely high level and learning and paying attention and practicing. And she owned her own bakery. It's actually an alcohol infused bakery.
An actual bakery.
Yeah.
Because guys, like, we're not just talking about baking here. I don't know if you're catching on to this.
just so many different, like, you guys are, we're Inception right now. We're like 12 layers deep.
Yes.
So, but like, yeah, the point is she had to invest that time and work her ass off for years to finally get to the point where she can go, oh, okay, I know that you're told never to do this, but actually if you do this and this and this, you can get away with it.
Right.
But that's too much information for most people, right? So like, I don't need to worry about your, again, your lion's mane infusion. We need to worry, step back and go, okay, are we eating a variety of vegetables? No, like, do you realize, are you paying attention to the fact that every time you eat spinach, it really hurts your stomach? No. Oh, yeah, weird. Huh? Let's worry about that before we worry about your $600 a month CoQ10 supplement.
Mm-hmm.
Like, let's come back to here, because you're breaking rules right now before you even understand what you're actually eating.
Right. So what are the keys to becoming like a solid Yelp review local restaurant chef? We're not talking about, you know, 5-star Michelin review or whatever it's called, but just a solid local restaurant. What are the keys?
That's a really good question. To me, it would be, can you simply execute the things within your capacity? So when I go to that local, there's a local Indian restaurant right down the street here, same thing, like 50 Yelp reviews or something. And it's freaking fantastic. But I go there wanting 4 or 5 different things. I don't go there wanting a really good crispy waffle, right? Because like, they're going to be like, oh, well, I mean, sure, we're pretty high level here, but I guess we can make a waffle, but that's not really what we do.
Mm-hmm.
Focusing on what it is like you do and not overextending yourself with all these other things. So master those basics. Master those basic tenets of portion control, timing, matching your performance goals with your energy goals throughout the day, with your sleep goals, with your mental goals, with your body composition goals. Understand food for those basic outcomes, and then we can start playing around with other things. So those to me would be the things I'd say focus on: portion control, variety, and understanding how you're feeling personally when you take that, right? So some people respond better to, some people can have 85 grams of carbohydrate at dinner and be fine. And some people eat 85 grams of carbohydrates and halfway through their face is bouncing off the plate because they're bleh. Like, just paying attention to how you feel in response to these different foods that you're cooking and you're preparing them. So you notice when you cooked your spinach, it made your stomach worse. When you eat it raw, it was fine. Fantastic. You're understanding what the food is doing to you, because remember, you're your own chef, and really the chef is the body, is
right,
is the meal is the outcome. So how are you feeling? That's what I would say.
So it sounds like two of the big pieces are tracking what you are putting into your body and then having some self-reflection on how that makes you feel.
I don't know if I would say the word tracking. I would say, because I don't want people to get the impression that they literally have to have MyFitnessPal or actually tracking, but I would say at least consciousness, like, and being aware of picking up a food item and going, oh, like, I really don't know how much fat is in that. Maybe I should take a look real fast. Oh, okay, I realize. And it can be just a mental awareness. Mm-hmm. Maybe awareness is the better word. Just being aware of roughly what's happening, and then that reflection is probably better.
Love it, man. So I've got some more personal questions for you. You're a super high achieving individual. You've got a ton of different things going on. So I kind of want to dive into how you operate as a professional. And the first one is, this one kind of hits close to home, because I consider myself much a generalist, and I often get really insecure about the fact that I don't have a depth of knowledge in any field, such as like you do. So I'm wondering what value you derive by being like a true expert in your field.
Well, so I would push back 100% on that, because I feel the exact same way.
Mm. Wow.
I've heard people say this, refer to this as the charlatan complex. And the vast majority of people I know in this field, if you press that exact same button, all of them be like, oh no, I'm not the guy in this field.
Wow.
This is the guy, or she's the girl. Like, she's the this is not, some of us are just blind and arrogant enough to feel like that. But I actually consider myself, actually, going back to the beginning, one of the things I regret about going on Joe's show, not I shouldn't say regret, but I could say I should do better, is I didn't have a particularly good answer for when he asked me what the hell I do. So
right.
I'm like,
yeah, right at the beginning.
What do I do? And I spent honestly probably like a year thinking about it, because people ask me all the time, like, well, so when you work with an athlete, like, what do you exactly do? I'm like, do you do their meal plans? Well, sometimes. Sometimes not. Do you do their strength conditioning? Sometimes. Do the program. What do I do? And so I've really thought back, and like, what I honestly feel like I do is I'm a professional decision maker. And the decisions I help them make is in the areas and the entire complex area of human performance. And so what I do is I try to look at as many of the things that are influencing their outcome as possible, and then go, you know what? I think this is not a food issue. I think this is a sleep issue. Let's go find somebody who really knows what the fuck they're doing with sleep.
Mm-hmm.
Or I don't think this is a problem. This is not sleep. This is all actually a performance anxiety issue. We need to find a sports psychologist. Or this is, I think you got something going on in the gut. And so because I know these areas at a reasonable level, I'm probably a little bit better than most at being able to identify, you think it's this here and somebody told you it's your glutathione production in your liver. It's really the fact you're training way too much. Because I know enough about strength conditioning to see your program and go, that's just too much volume for what you did last program. I see what the increase there. And so I would say I'm a hyper generalist like that too. And I think this went up the other day. Joe had my buddy Brian Callen on the show. And Callen is an actor, and he talked about, like, I helped him about a year ago get rid of his psoriasis. And then I got blown up with everyone being like, oh my God, I have psoriasis. Like, how do I get rid of it? I'm like, how do I get rid of it? Is I went through a bunch of stuff. We spent about 2 months trying things. None of that worked. And I started to get with enough information, I actually thought he had something going on in the gut. So then I reached out to my colleague, Dan Garner. And Dan did some testing on his gut and came back. And yeah, he had some shit going on there. We corrected that. And all of a sudden, his psoriasis has been gone for like 9 months. So my point being, like, I defer to the people who are truly, truly specialized in those smaller areas when I figure it out. But my best ability, the reason why people hire me is to help them figure out of all these different areas, like, where do I spend my resources and my time?
Super interesting, man. And for what it's worth, you obviously have a deep knowledge of muscle physiology and exercise science compared to the layperson. And I was talking,
okay, fair enough,
I was talking to, do you know John Berardi, former
I don't know
founder
of course, I know who he is.
Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
Ian's fantastic.
I was chatting with him the other day, and he was talking about how he looks at success, like what he thinks you need to be a really successful person. And he drew a T for me. And he said, you want to have this really broad knowledge across everything and whatever industry you're interested in. But then you want to have one vertical where you have some level of depth of knowledge. And it sounds like that's exactly what you're bringing to your athletes.
Yeah, I hope so. I would agree though, the T thing, I've heard that before, and it's, I fully agree. I mean, there's one area that people probably don't care about that I'm like, I've really probably read more than just about anybody on this issue. But the rest of it, it's that top of the T for sure.
So you're a full-time professor, you're a scientist, you work for professional athletes, you create content, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. How do you manage all of this? How do you prioritize your time and your projects?
Well, on one hand, I'll give you the exact same answer probably everyone gives you. It's the standard cliche stuff in terms of, batching work. So trying to not be distracted when I'm writing, say, or doing the high creativity stuff, to not have email open. I don't do certain tasks like real high level problem solving when my door is open and students are coming in. I think it sounds sort of maybe like boring to hear, but it's extremely true. That's a big part of being very productive, not having to redo your work. Knowing when I'm in my office and the door is going to be open, I'm going to do the stuff that maybe takes time, but it's not high level stuff in my world. That's creating, it's organization, it's responding to quick emails, things like that. Mm-hmm. The other part of it is, again, standard stuff, but it's really important. I have a fantastic team. My postdoc Irene Tobias and my grad students are just really, really, really amazing. I think the more unique things I can contribute to this are, I don't have to worry about running a business of any kind. I don't have like any of that stuff to worry about. So I can really do things that I generally want to do. And I don't have to, I mean, we all do stuff I don't want to do. But I have a lot of freedom because I have that financial security behind me, knowing that like my university is pretty much stays the hell away from me.
Right.
And I can really kind of do what I want to do, and I don't have to worry about budgeting. And I have, I'm able to live a lifestyle that's far above my actual financial income because I can leverage the university for stability.
Sure.
Effectively. There are some unique things that I think I do that have helps, and I'm happy to share those if you want, but my global answer would be it's the same stuff probably a lot of people on the show have said.
Well, let's assume people have no idea what batching is, because this one was a huge one for me. What is that?
Oh, yeah. So, I mean, just something like right now I try to lock in and do all of my, say, teaching in the same day. So I try to get on campus, and like Mondays, I teach an 8 o'clock class. I teach a 4 o'clock class. And so I get on campus, you know, I leave my house by 5:30 in the morning, and I'm not home until 8:30 or so PM. So Monday and Wednesday are like that, but they're extremely long days. But I try to do my teaching and teacher related activities all on the exact same days. So I go in early before my first class. I'm grading, or I'm putting together stuff that I need for that class. I go to do that class. And so while my brain is fresh into that class, what we just talk about, what did I say, what's coming up next, I can handle all the activities for that class for the next couple of weeks and prior to that, because I'm not going back and going like, oh, wait, what the hell did I say in that class again? Like, what are we doing? And I'm not trying to do that another day. My brain is very much focused on that class for a 2 or 3 hour period. And then my brain goes completely away. And then it goes to my grad students. And then I'll spend the next couple of hours being like, what tasks do I need for them? What do I need to get back to them? Boom. And then the same thing for my next class. And then Tuesdays are typically 100% wide open. I don't like to schedule anything on Tuesdays because that's when I stay home and that's when I write. And so no email goes up. I'll check it in the morning, but then when I sit down to write, the email gets shut down. The phone goes away. My computers are going. I knock all this stuff out of the way, so I get up, dogs are exercised, food, water, kids off to school or whatever, and then I'm like, there's just no other possible distractions. So I can batch that operation, and I like 3, 4, 5, 6 hours, and then I like to take a phone call, an athlete call, a podcast about halfway through that day, so like 10 a.m., and then the same thing at like 2 or 3. So I'll do 3, 4 hours of work, then I'll have some actual social interaction, and I'll talk to someone, and this gives me, like, I get a lot of energy from this. I love it. I love communicating and learning. So I'm like, then I get kind of fired up and then I'm like, all right, but it's not so distracting. I have to really put like a high level processing and thinking about these things. I'll finish this, get some water, move around a little bit, maybe roll out, you know, jump on the Airdyne for 5 minutes or something like that, check stuff, and then right back into that task or the next one. And so I just put like-minded activities in the exact same time together. This is really my version of batching so that I don't have to keep moving my head back, because what happens in my world of writing is I'm trying to go through, I mean, tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of data points in an Excel file, and I'm trying to figure out what is this data telling me, what is it not doing. And if you try to do that, well, every time if you put it down, then pick it up 3 or 4 days later, put it down, pick it up, it takes you half an hour, 45 minutes to even remember what the hell you left off the last time. And so you end up redoing a lot of work, and it just takes a long time. So it's just far more effective if, and I'll often do like writing retreats where I'll just leave on Thursday, go to a cabin, and I come back Sunday with the project done. This is how I do. This is how we shoot the body of knowledge. The next one is just like, well, write, and then I don't shoot anything until it's like, let's just knock the whole thing out in 2 days. So that's what I mean by batching work. And like one of the things I've done is, I noticed in my classes, which are the lectures that the students had the most difficulty with and the ones that I got the least questions in. The ones I also felt had the least student interaction. And I thought, okay, instead of me wasting my time doing those lectures over and over again, then that's going to result in a bunch of emails and then a bunch of students coming in my office. And the students are going to perform the worst on this stuff. well, why not just take all those, record those, put them on my screen capture, etc. I have a film crew at the university, mm-hmm. like Cal State Fullerton actually has a green screen, a team that does this for me.
Amazing.
So again, it's like, that's what I mean when I can say, like, I can do things that people in the private sector don't mm-hmm. have to, because that's all paid for me. So I go in there, I knock these things out, they produce, they edit it, they give it to me. I throw it up on my YouTube page. So that creates content for the YouTube page, etc., for my public domain. I take those videos and I put those in as my class lecture. So for example, on Monday, we didn't meet as a class. They had like 2.5 hours of videos for my YouTube page to watch on the physiology of endurance. Okay, well, that's really complicated stuff. And so it's typically a lot of questions, or solves all the problems. So we don't meet in that day. They watch all the videos. The students understand it really well. We've had some good ex-phys before. They can kind of cruise through it, or they can listen to the audio version only. Students that struggle can go back. They don't have to stop. They can record. It's all up there. They don't have to worry about writing the right thing down to study notes. It's all right there for them. Then on Wednesday for class, they show up, and we go out in the field, and we do a bunch of tasks. Like, they actually do this physiology, or these conditioning tests. And in the middle of the test, they actually have to take a quiz, like an actual quiz on the material. And it's questions like, okay, when we just did that round, why is your leg burning right now? What's the physiology here? When we did this task, how did this feel different? Like, explain exactly what's going on in the cardiovascular system right now relative to the metabolic system. But it's in a competition setting too. So the groups that finish the thing first get the most points, but then every question they miss on the exam adds time to their total.
Oh, shit. That is gold.
So it's really, really cool. And then we have like a recap session of that where we go over question and answer and fill in these things. So it saves me a ton of time. The student engagement is 1,000x. It's going to resonate with them a lot more. Plus, the fact that I put that content up for free, anyone else in the world can basically take any of my classes that they want. And then I throw it up actually on my Patreon account. People can contribute to that. The money I bring in for that actually I use to either give my students or other stuff to say, hey, here's money to do something that buys me time so I can go shoot these videos.
Yep.
And it's things like that, like, hey, will you cover my class so I can actually go home and shoot this video or whatever? Or will you go do whatever else I have to do? So it looks like I'm being extremely productive because they're like, man, your YouTube page is all over it. You're doing this. I'm like, yeah, but it's all the same damn thing.
Yeah. You're maximizing the content.
Exactly.
Got it. Yeah, the batching one, man, that really is fundamental to productivity. I was coming up with a bit of an analogy as you were talking that I've never thought of. It's like, imagine you have to compete in a max snatch event. You have to do Fran, and then you also have to play a violin. But the way that you try to do those three events, competitive events, is you do one snatch, and then you go play the violin for a couple minutes, and then you go and do like a couple reps of pull-ups. And so you're really never fully warming up or getting into a flow with any of those movements. And it's the same with work output, right? If we're checking text messages, emails, we're writing, we're getting on and off meetings, we're constantly having to focus, refocus. And Cal Newport and some others put it, I think they call it attention residue, right? Every time we switch tasks, there's an attention residue such that it takes us 5+ minutes to refocus on something. So if you can just have to do that one time, then you can actually get into a flow state and do your best work, whatever that is.
Yeah. And then I actually started like kind of super batch, if you will, where I have a calendar. It's a whiteboard actually. And I have the entire year on the whiteboard, and I have just like the non-negotiable deadlines mm-hmm. for the entire year laid out in front of me. And so I can look and go, oh shit, okay. For whatever reason, I got 4 or 5 non-negotiables in August. Okay, this may be like a grant deadline or something or other. Well, I'm going to look back then and go look at July and say, okay, well, that paper, whatever I wanted to get out this summer, if it's not out by July, it's not coming out because I'm going to get hammered in August. Mm. And so then what I can do is say, okay, July is really focused on X study. June is focused on this study. May was focused on, is really a teaching month for me because it's finals week. There's extra stuff there. I know it's going to be a really heavy teaching month. So my expectations when all of a sudden I get an extra hour one day, I know in May I go, okay, extra hour right now. Let me get ahead of my teaching right now. Instead of going back into this paper thing that, because I know I'm going to dive into it hard in June and I want all my attention right on it there. I have these kind of like mini themes for the week, the month, and really sort of the semester. And it sounds like awesome or cool, but it's just strength conditioning.
Right.
It's exactly how you program design.
Right.
It's just like, I just wrote a macrocycle. I had a focus for every mesocycle. It's the same damn thing. It's actually even worse than that. You know, I grew up in the country. My dad and my grandpa were road construction workers, and I worked for them my life growing up. And it's the exact same thing that a foreman does. They go through and figure out, like, well, we got all this shit to do, but right now we got an hour, so let's do the task that takes an hour. And let's focus. And if we get that done, then that'll free up this time over here, and then we can really focus on this, and there'll be no distractions. Like, it's just program or project management. It's
right.
It's the same exact tool, the tool set or skill set that you can use and plug it into your life however you want.
The interesting thing for me over the past 5 or 6 years has been that it's the way that you build these skills is exactly how you build muscle or skill in sport, right? You can't, I don't think anyone listening could go from being a slouch high school student to performing at the same level that we are in terms of time management, energy management, et cetera. You have to kind of pick up one piece at a time and master each habit. And then it just, as you mature and you're intentional about how you're using your time and energy, you can start to pick up more and more of these skills.
And I'm not like, for anyone listening to, and I'm not a person who identifies as extremely organized like that.
Mm.
That's not something that was inherent. Or something, I was like, oh, you've always been super OCD. I am the furthest from that.
Likewise.
But I learned, I mean, I learned in college. I was a college football player. I was had a fairly difficult degree and I worked. I cleaned dorm rooms for 4 years in college, which is sort of funny because typically the football players are kind of like the bit of the big guys on campus. Mm-hmm. And then it's like in between football practice or before football practice, I'm in there like vacuuming a dorm room.
You look more like a punter though. Punters don't get that same treatment.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, so that's an example of, I had to be, I mean, anyone that's ever played college sports, particularly I'm biased towards football, but the time management is crazy. The time demand in college football is out of control. So I had to just be super dialed because I'm taking 15 to 17 units. And football practice basically is 2 o'clock till 9 o'clock. And then Saturday on weekends, you're traveling.
Right.
And so I had to have, I mean, Doug Larson and I, we would have, okay, Sunday, 10 o'clock, we're doing anatomy from 10 to 11. 11 o'clock to 12, we're going to go eat. 12 o'clock to 1, we're doing biomechanics. 1 o'clock, and it was like, okay, we got an hour. Well, I got to read a chapter, and then we need to quiz each other. It's like, shit, okay. And it's just like, there was no other option because I knew at 1 o'clock, if I'm behind on that, like we had to move on the next one. We had to move on the next one because we had to have this done. But then, so when you set yourself those time limits, you get very, very, very good at managing things. And then you make sure that those things are done as opposed to being like, yeah, Saturday, let's work on homework.
Right.
You're never going to get it done.
Yeah.
You're just never going to get it done. Like you'll never be there on time. So
way too vague. Love it, man. Who are you currently learning from?
A ton. Top of mind, I just said Brian. So Brian's someone I'm always bouncing stuff off of. Let's see. Kind of what areas am I spending more time on? I won't give you a name here because it's not an individual person, but...
It's not a real person, you said? Or an individual.
Individual.
Okay, gotcha.
I mean, I love reading Scientific American. I mean, I've typically heard a lot of the stuff before I get into it, but that's a fantastic journal. It's it's written for an intelligent person, but you don't have to have any scientific background per se to read those articles there. I can't ever get enough of Carl Sagan. It's just anyone that's putting out things on like logic and epistemology will jazz me up for sure. So those are all, boy, this is one of those ones I'm going to go back and be like, oh my God, how did I not say this or this or this person? So there's probably a ton. I'm trying to sort of think through the people that I follow or consume a bunch. I mentioned Rob, actually. I think Rob is doing a great job, Wolf, earlier. I can't speak to what he's done in the past. I've only really paid attention to his content in the last year or a couple of years or something like that. And some of the stuff he's doing, I'm like, finally, one of you cuckoos from the other side here is saying some really helpful shit. So he's a person I've enjoyed. And we are still, like, there's a couple of topics we are completely on opposite of the spectrums. Right. But I think he's landing more towards, I'm like, yeah, this is good stuff.
I could trust this guy now.
Yeah, like, yeah, for the most part, I feel like he's one of the few people in the industry who's closer to genuine.
Gotcha.
You know, who I'm like, okay, now I get it. You have to run a business. I'm not the person who's like, oh, he's got a business behind it. He's like, no, I know a lot of people, you guys are included, that run businesses where their product is directly supported by this, but they're, like, I trust them 100% in terms of they're very genuine, and I don't think they're doing it for the sake of putting stuff out there.
Right.
Other people that you may throw in the same category as Rob Wolf, I would not say that about. In fact, I'd say the exact opposite. So,
right.
He's great. I mean, he doesn't need any more help getting promotion out there. I think, like, I try to read as much stuff that Marie Spano puts out. Marie's fantastic.
I haven't heard of her.
She's a dietitian. Okay. Oh my God, dude, she's killer. Dietitian for the Atlanta Hawks, the Atlanta Falcons, and the Atlanta Braves.
Gotcha.
She's just spectacular.
What are you liking from her?
I just puts out nutrition content that's like I wouldn't say it's like next level, but it's like kind of like second level, if you will.
Okay.
She's not just gonna like post a picture of, you know, like, here's my recipe for my taco salad.
Right.
Whatever. But she's gonna take research. And as well as her actual experience, again, working with a lot of professional athletes,
right,
kind of put out stuff that's real digestible. And she, I think, does a very good job on her blog and her social media of taking the controversial topics, so GMOs or vaccinations or these kind of areas, and being like, no, here's a distillation of what the science really says. And she is, I think, one of the other reasons I love her the most is, I got kind of into this a little bit with some dietitians the other day, but I think that profession has shot itself in the foot a lot. I think the reason it's not trusted on a global scale is mostly its own doing. And a good example is Marie, because she's one of the first people who I heard that was like, no, there is something to this small intestinal bacterial overgrowth. Because it's just like all functional medicine guru shit. There is something to heavy metal toxins. There is something to all this stuff. Because most of the dietitians were just like, no, 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 all like woo-woo stuff. And so she's someone who I think really does listen to that new wave stuff, really pays attention to it, and then goes, no, bullshit. Or, no, there's something here I need to learn. I need to learn more. And she moves her game a lot. So people like that, I think, are give the dietitians a very, very, very good name. And so she's someone who I really like a lot, and I can listen to her stuff. And again, I don't agree with everything she says either, but she's the best kind of practitioner in my mind.
Gotcha, man. I'm excited to look into her further. She sounds great.
Yeah, I mean, she doesn't have a social media team or anything like that, so some of her posts are, like, they're not the prettiest pictures and things you've ever seen, but the content's really solid.
Oh, if the pictures aren't pretty, I'm not looking that shit up.
Agreed.
Man, this was phenomenal. I appreciate your time as always, Andy.
It's a pleasure to always be here, man. Good to see you again.
Where can people find all of that content that you're putting out?
Oh, it's easy, man. AndyGalpin.com, the YouTube, search for the YouTube, search for the Patreon, and social media is easy. I think it's just DR, like Dr. Andy Galpin. It's all up.
Got it. And the Body of Knowledge podcast. It's phenomenal, guys.
Thanks, man. We are, I don't know if I should announce this yet. We haven't actually formally announced it yet, but we're about to film on season 3 here. So
sweet.
Content coming like 2021 or something.
Yeah, right. Love it, man. Looking forward to it. Thanks as always, brother.
This episode is finished, but your training journey continues. Head over to brutestrengthtraining.com/SSW and grab your free pack of 32 accessory workouts that you can incorporate into your training and start improving your strength immediately. That's brutestrengthtraining.com/SSW.